From the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
Sure sign that it's Friday when Felix Bunnell joins us for All Over the Map. A quick look at the stories behind the names of local places. And this week, Felix, you are focusing on a tiny piece of land jutting out into the water just north of Tacoma, which holds the historic Browns Point Lighthouse.
Yeah, and it's a distinctive-looking lighthouse. It's not a cylinder. It's more of a tall box shape, sort of an Art Deco concrete tower about 40 feet tall. It was built in 1933. Before that, in 1903, there was a wooden lighthouse. And before that, in 1887, there was what's called a stake light, just a lantern hanging from a pole they'd have to go add fuel to every couple days. Now, it's not clear who Browns Point, you know, with no apostrophe, was named for. Perhaps an early settler. The U.S. Navy called it Point Harris in 1841 for a sailmaker named Alvin Harris, who was part of that expedition that charted the waters around here, but that name didn't stick. Ironically, it was not named for Oscar Brown, even though he was the lighthouse keeper from 1903 to 1939. I think that's 36 years, so don't worry, Dave, you have that guy beat by almost a decade here at Cairo.
Sometimes I feel like I'm manning a lighthouse.
Yes. There's a wonderful nonprofit group called the Points Northeast Historical Society. They've been raising money and restoring all the buildings there. They've got a bunch of grants. They have about $40,000 left to raise. The final step is restoring the lighthouse itself, which will include removing the plywood from the windows, replacing the windows, repainting, replacing this cool, ornate cupola that used to be on top. Now, it's still operational and maintained by the Coast Guard. This isn't just some fancy-schmancy toy, right? This is a serious bit of navigational aids here, but it's been automated since 1963. One thing that's sad, there's no foghorn there anymore. It got removed about a decade ago because modern navigation gear made it obsolete. And so I asked Jim Harnish, who's vice president of the Points Northeast Historical Society, if anyone had ever made a recording of that foghorn. You know, I'd love to have some old tape like that. He said no, so I asked him what it used to sound like.
I think it was the traditional, you know, sound, that kind of sound. But
that's pretty good. Do that again. That's a good impersonation. Let me hear that one more time. So worst case, if it got really foggy, you could go down there yourself and just...
Yes, right. Have a big megaphone. Yeah.
So the grounds are open there to the public even during the pandemic. And one very cool thing, when there isn't a COVID pandemic underway, the very charming lightkeeper's quarters, like this very nice little house, you can rent that as an Airbnb and stay there and pretend to be a lighthouse keeper.
All right.
So
embrace the loneliness.
Really, yeah, and just a fabulous, gorgeous visual landmark and a really cool part of Northwest history.
Felix Bunnell, all his features at MyNorthwest.com. Have a good weekend.
You too. Thanks, Dave.
Everybody saw it. Russell is back. The Seahawks are back. They beat the Arizona Cardinals 28-21 last night at the newly rechristened Lumen Field, and what a game.
Well, I think that we're capable of anything all the time, and so we're really excited about getting Carson back and Carlos and what those guys can help us do and give us so much versatility. You know, we want to be able to obviously throw it and do our things in the passing game.
Play fake. Russ is going to roll to the right side, stops, looks, steps up in the pocket. Now he's going to scramble. Now he's going to throw to the end zone. He's got a man. Touchdown, Seahawks. DK Metcalf. Play made by Russell Wilson, scrambling out of the pocket to his right side, and Metcalf comes all the way across the back of the end zone, outrunning Patrick Peterson, and the ball was absolutely perfect. The Seahawks on their opening drive go up 6-0.
I felt like the Seahawks that we've all seen over the years. Carlos did a great job tonight. He did exactly what we needed. We needed him to run hard and run tough, knock people backwards and make extra yards with you know, his juice. And the guys up front responded with him. You know, I don't know, we had 80 yards or something like that. That was a really good contribution to this effort tonight, and it balanced us out.
Hand off inside to Hyde. He breaks free. 20, 15, 10. Knocked off his feet. Carlos Hyde right up the gut. Arizona made it look like they were going to bring about nine guys. They step back, and Hyde runs right past them. Simmons makes the tackle. An 18-yard run and another first down. First and goal, Seahawks. First down and 10 from the 11. Russ has time. Got a man in the back of the end zone. Reaching up, feet down. It is Lockett. Touchdown, Seahawks. Tyler Lockett dragging the toenails once again. Back corner of the end zone. And a perfect teardrop pass from Russell Wilson. The Seahawks go back on top. 13-7.
Yeah, I think it was a good night for the whole crew. You know, Brian, Austin, Davis, those guys working with Russ and Dave Canales, those guys, you know, they're all teaming together to make sure that we're giving us the best chance to do things, you know, consistently good, well, and we did it, you know, and so it was a nice night.
And here's Russ right back to the line of scrimmage. First and goal at the two. The handoff to Hyde. He is in. Touchdown, Seahawks. Thank you, 15-yard penalty, but the Seahawks muscle this one in on the shoulders of Carlos Hyde. Two runs back-to-back puts the Seahawks in the end zone and puts them on top now, 22-14.
Well, the huge thing is the defense just keeps getting better and better. You know, and we're excited. We're excited about, you know, who we are as, you know, as a team. You know, we believe that, you know, as we continue to go out through the season, this has always been the case here, is that we always have this growth, you know, and this trajectory of continuing to grow and get better. And I think the exciting part for us is that we all sense that, we all feel that, and we can control that too as well, in terms of how we prepare, how we get ready, you know, how each game goes, and we feel really excited about where we're going.
1 yard deep is going to bring it out across the 5-10, and he gets hit and dropped back at the 10-yard line. Great coverage downfield by Ryan Neal, and he is hopping all over the field being chased by his teammates. Arizona starts deep in their own end. From 41, kick is away, kick is up, kick is good. Jason Myers stays perfect, and the Seahawks stretch their lead to 7. 2:19 to play, Seattle leads 28-21.
It's been great. You know, he had, I think, a sack earlier, then a sack to win the game. And, you know, his big thing when he got here was he wanted to get after the quarterback, and that's exactly what he's doing. You know, it's fun to watch. It's fun to watch his energy. It's fun to watch him try to communicate with the crowd that's not there. And so it's really cool. I'm glad to have him on our team.
Three receivers, Fitzgerald, that is, and Kirk go to the far side. Empty backfield. Murray takes the snap. Looks. Gets hit. Goes down. Seahawks sack. Murray getting there was Dunlap. Came off the edge, almost untouched. Huge play by the Seahawks defense. And the Hawks are going to win this game at Lumen Field. And it's going to come on a great defensive play with 34 seconds left.
You know, we'll see. We got to keep coming back and play and keep going. We're just really, it feels like we're just getting started. There's no reason that we can't come together and play really good football. There's no reason and from this point forward.
Going to a weekend. I love the imagery. Tyler Lockett, dragging toenails, teardrop pass, and the virtual crowd goes wild. You forget that there's nobody in the stadium.
Yeah, that caught my attention, too, and I looked at our team's video call because I thought, a teardrop pass? And Sully used charades to tell me and describe what that meant. I'd never heard that phrase before.
There you go. Anyway,
love
great
it.
Game, and they're back on top of the NFC West. The West Seattle Bridge decision is in, and it's going to be repaired, not replaced. Mayor Durkin made the decision yesterday. That means traffic should be back on the bridge by the middle of 2022. And Chris is going to answer all of our questions about the plan. So what was the main reason for choosing this?
Well, basically, Durkin said that replacing the bridge would have just taken too long. She didn't want to leave West Seattle without a bridge for 5 or 6 years. She also didn't want to risk the thousands of maritime jobs connected to the expanded Terminal 5 at the Port of Seattle. She said that coming out of COVID, Seattle's going to have to fight for every job, especially those blue-collar jobs there. So that was one of the biggest factors. And the other one was that if we can get the years out of this repair that is promised, the 15 to 40 years, that gives the city a little bit of time to work with Sound Transit, and so that the next bridge that is built over the Duwamish River, Mayor Durkin hopes will be a combo with Sound Transit as they take their light rail over to West Seattle. So those are kind of three of the bigger reasons why she went with repair.
That means it's going to be a long time before West Seattle gets light rail then.
Well, I mean, we are looking at 15 years now anyway. I mean, they're looking at 2035 unless they find some way to elevate that. And considering the amount of money Sound Transit has lost due to COVID and their projections,
I was hoping to ride that
pushed.
Train.
Well, you'll be able to ride that train. You just won't be able to ride it to West Seattle or Ballard. You'll be able to get to Renton. You'll be able to get to Redmond and Bellevue. Isn't that good enough for you?
Yeah, I guess. What if the repair doesn't work? How sure are they this is going to work?
Well, that's the thing. All the experts from the technical advisory panel to the engineers inside of SDOT, the outside experts, believe that this repair can give them 15 to 40 years. They believe that. But the X factor in all of this is that the shoring work, which is underway right now to basically stabilized the bridge. Mm-hmm. It hasn't gone through a full winter cycle yet, and they don't know how the bridge is going to react with the post-tensioning they've done and the carbon fiber wrapping, if that's going to handle the expansion and contraction based on the weather through a full winter season. They get to March and April, and they realize, boy, this thing didn't perform like we thought. They could have to go to Plan B, which is to pivot to replacement right away. But they think it's going to hold and give them those years.
I read something in the story about they're going to be cutting into a neoprene bearing on the bridge, which I presume is one of those rubber things that that holds it up.
That's already been done. They did that at Pier 18. Yo, they did that at the Pier 18. That was the locked bearing that was exacerbating the cracking. That was done 2 weeks ago. So that bearing has been released. And so that's all part of the ongoing stabilization work.
And everything's okay then. See, that just sounds like a scary thing because that holds the whole bridge up, right?
Well, yeah, it does. I mean, it's basically, you know, a stuck bearing and that was just not allowing the bridge to move like it needs to under load. And so they released that bearing.
So it has now been unfrozen and the bridge is still there. So that's good.
That is correct. Okay. So, and again, they don't know how it's going to react to when they put load on it, you know, but still, that was one of the reasons that joint was locked and it didn't allow the bridge to move freely with the conditions and the load that exacerbated the cracking that they had as well. So that was a key part of
the stabilization. Okay, because I thought the source of the cracking was still a mystery, but the problem was that the bearing was frozen and the thing couldn't move freely.
Well, that's a contributing factor. They're still looking at some of the other reasons for the cracking as well, but that didn't help it. The fact that Pier 18 was locked, that bearing was locked, didn't help matters and actually made the cracking worse. And once they realized that, that's why they shut it down in March. It just wasn't safe.
Okay, so middle of 2022, but I understand they're going to try to, they're going to do a warp speed version of this to try to get it in earlier?
Well, the thing is that 2022 was kind of a conservative effort. That's how long they think it is going to take because, one, they have to get through, as I said, the winter season contracting. The construction on the repair was supposed to start in the fall of next year. But what they're hoping is that they can accelerate that a little bit. They might be able to get a lane or two on before opening up to full capacity before 2022, the middle of, maybe early on. So they're going to try to do this as fast as they can, as safely as they can. Certainly, they're not going to sacrifice safety for speed, but there's a hope that they might get it done in less than so. It's like 18, 19 months left for West Seattle, which is going to be brutal. Yeah. The 8 months that they've lived through this right now has been hard. Another 18, 19 months, it's going to be very difficult for people living in West Seattle.
Down but not out. A COVID patient found a way to say thank you without words. And CBS's Chip Reed has the story.
COVID patient Grover Wilhelmson's request from his ICU bed was one his medical team probably had never heard before. Intubated and unable to speak at Intermountain Healthcare's McKay D Hospital last month, the retired music teacher used paper and pen to ask if his wife Diana could bring his violin so he could play as a thank you to the doctors and nurses.
Was he speaking through that violin?
That was the only way he could speak. And he let the violin do the talking for him because he couldn't talk himself.
He wrote the note to nurse Sierra Sassy.
What was your reaction when you first heard him play?
I cried.
She was so inspired, she piped the music into the hallway so her colleagues could hear.
How important was it to you that he did this for you?
One of my coworkers described it as, a light in the COVID darkness, which I think is perfect.
She says he played his heart out and it touched hers.
This is something that will follow me for the rest of my career.
Sometimes music is the very best medicine for the patients and those who heal. Chip Reed, CBS News, Washington.
It's something to see, too, him with the, tube in his mouth and down his neck playing that violin. But I wanted to mention, because a couple days ago you showed me that you actually contributed to one of the daily doses of kindness, the kindness size. Bought
two blind
some
brothers.
Clothing. From two blind brothers. These are the brothers who sell clothing. One of their most popular is the mystery box, where, like somebody who might be blind, sometimes they don't always know what they're getting.
So you
got this. So what did they send you, Dave?
It included, I got the socks. That included two baseball-style caps with very subtle braille on the inside, but they were baseball caps. And two pair of these carbon sunglasses.
Oh.
And the carbon cases. You know what those are, Chris, right? Very slick. And,
yeah.
Knit beanies. It was very classy stuff, actually.
Oh, you better wear that.
Yeah, well, I know you need to wear the beanie with that beard, Dave. Yeah. Although I
and
want
with
a
the glasses
hat on you.
And the glasses.
I want to see the beanie and the glasses. I want hipster Dave.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you for contributing. Again, the company is called Two Blind Brothers, and the proceeds from that mystery box go towards finding a cure for their genetic degenerative disease that caused them to start going
really
blind when they were 5 and 7 years. They look cushy.
Yeah, they're cushy.
They look real nice.
And now, from the Gian Ursula Show, the man who predicted last night's win, G. Scott.
Hey, I told you, Russ cooks better with a sous chef.
But did he call the score? I feel like he was really close to the score, too.
No, I don't remember. You didn't get me down for the score, did you, Dave? I don't think so.
Well, we were just looking for it, because I thought I'd ask. Usually I do ask you for it, but for some reason I was off my game yesterday. What happens?
Yeah, it does happen. Not very rarely does it happen with you. But here's the deal. The Seahawks team, I told you, number three. Again, he cooks better when he has a sous chef. The sous chef is the run game. Well, Dave, you look at the run game. Yes. Look at Carlos Hyde.
Right.
He had 14 carries for 79 yards. Bo Scarborough getting in there. DJ Dallas getting there. They rushed. They ran the ball for 165 yards as a team. And, of course, Russell Wilson, he doesn't need to throw for that many yards. He went 23 for 28. This is the old school Russ where he doesn't need to throw it that much, and he gets busy. Team win. Excellent job by the defense holding this Arizona Cardinals team.
Okay, did they come out of it uninjured so that they can do it again? What is it, Thursday?
Oh, that's a Colleen question. Colleen always asks me about the injuries, Dave.
What can I say? I'm an empathetic individual. I want to know
Colleen,
about
go ahead, ask me about the injuries.
Health and well-being of our Seahawks players. But there was an injury or two.
The Greg Olsen, that kind of looked a little scary. That was kind of a non-contact. You can tell that was on the foot. I'm kind of worried about that whole deal. And then Bo Scarborough, the running back, that was a split he did. I was hurting here. As a matter of fact, I woke up this morning hurting from watching that.
So what does that mean? I mean, this is Tell the Truth Friday. Did they win because they were that much better, or because Arizona was hurting? And if that's the case, who's up next?
No. The Seahawks won because they played a very good game. Again, the defense held them to 7 points in the first half. The defense held this Arizona team to the lowest amount of points scored that they've scored all season. This was fantastic. And the Seahawks had a very good game plan. This was a game plan to go, by the way, 1-0 in Lumen Stadium.
Right.
1-0. And don't say they 1-0 at the Lou. Don't call it the Lou. That's the restroom.
I didn't think of that.
Don't do that. That's the restroom.
Oh.
That means life. Anyway.
But
well,
anyway.
We know that, but it sounds like cerumen to me, which is the medical term for earwax. So all I hear is cerumen,
Colleen,
when I hear Lumen Field.
Colleen, how were you able to bring that up on the show?
My mom was in the medical field, so she always taught us the proper names for everything. But I didn't think of the loo, so they took the clink from us and gave us the loo.
can I ask this? Why do we get so mad about change?
Because this is our house.
Well,
is where we come together. This is our town hall, our community gathering space.
We said the same thing when they turned into CenturyLink Field from Quest.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. It was Quest Field. Oh, my goodness. Okay. You know, hey, look, the proper name, the only name that I would love for that field to be called would be Paul Allen Stadium. A Paul Allen Field. That to me, I think that ultimately that is the name to be. I mean, you're talking about the
man that
single-handedly saved the Seahawks from leaving this town. I mean, we know
he could afford it, right?
We know well. I mean, you'd think that somebody could afford to keep the Sonics here, but that didn't happen. So we know how heartbreaking.
Oh wow! Now we're bringing it to the Sonics talk.
I mean,
we're really going full circle with the damage. damaged Seattle.
I mean, feelings are still hurt. I mean, look, there are some folks out there. Sometimes when the ex leaves you and runs out of town on you, you still feel it. And especially when you see them not do. You see the Sonics, the OKC Thunder down there. They haven't moved on. They aren't doing well. They were better here.
So then you're probably not a fan of Climate Pledge Arena. We've got Lumen Field, Climate Pledge Arena, and then what's
T-Mobile
Park? You okay with T-Mobile Park
now? I don't know. I like the pink, but this is some high level sports conversation.
She's also fine with the Carter
Super
Bowl studio. So
let's get to it. I just before we get out of this, I just want to say and remind everyone that the Seahawks, they're 7-3.
Yeah.
Woo!
They're 7-3. It felt like last week the Seahawks had only won one game if you look on social media. But right now they're 7-3. Everybody feels good. And you know, another thing I will say, there's something about when the Seahawks lose, especially now during what we're going through with this pandemic, it just hurts a little bit more. I noticed the extra amount of ice cream I ate last week after the loss. But this now, winning, going into the weekend, makes the weekend so
I hear, by the way, that's
much
pretty much
better.
Your regular amount of ice cream, but I won't say anything.
Ooh, Dave. Dave.
G joins Ursula. Ursula will get the truth out of him.
Okay, that beard right got here. You getting a little feisty, ain't you, Dave?
Oh, yeah. I'm unplugged now, G. With the beard, I'm unplugged.
By the way, for those interested, I did post a beard update.
Yeah, everyone's interested, Colleen.
They I want you to become an Instagram influencer for beard products. I mean, I'm your PR agent at this point. Y'all need to be paying me.
Yeah. My beard is an advertisement for masks is what it is.
Oh, Dave,
oh, my Christmas decorations
Dave,
just fell.
Can you take a picture of yourself wearing a mask with your beard coming out?
No, I cannot. Hannah Scott, the Seattle City Council is poised to approve nearly 20% in cuts to the police force. And we're going to find out where things stand on the SPD hiring freeze as well. Here she is.
It was just a few short months ago when we heard this from most of the city council members as thousands marched through the streets in protest.
And I think it's important for me as an elected official, who is a non-Black Mexican American in this country, to say that I take personal responsibility for every vote I have taken that has contributed to the expansion of law enforcement and those legal systems at the expense of community-based investments. And I owe it to all of you to say that I am sorry for those votes. I now have an opportunity, and so do my colleagues, to reverse and correct those past votes, those past choices, because we know that the current public safety model does not produce safety for Black, Indigenous, and Brown people. Now is the time to divest from a police department. Now is the time to zero out these budgets and to reimagine, rebuild, build something from a community-led and community-driven perspective that will actually build community safety for the people that have been harmed the most by over-policing and criminalization.
And the tone over the summer as the first battle over the push to defund SPD by 50% got underway.
7 out of 9 council members committed to cutting the Seattle Police Department's budget by 50% without talking to the chief of police.
And of course, all of that led to this.
Male, female, sworn, civilian, PhDs, JDs, everyone. We have an incredible group of people that we've assembled. And to even consider not compensating them fairly was ridiculous. Illegal, by the way, but also ridiculous. And so how else am I supposed to feel? There's a whole room full of department heads in here, and not one of them was named, just me. So, yeah, I take it personal.
The retirement of Police Chief Carmen Best. Now, just weeks later, a very different tone on the Seattle City Council as it takes one of the final steps to approve the Seattle Police Department budget. A final vote is set for Monday. And that's when the hiring freeze came up for SPD.
And so this isn't about just flipping a switch and saying, well, we took a budget action today and I signed it, and therefore tomorrow it's a safer place. We have to give folks an opportunity to actually absorb the investments, receive the investments, and build towards those community safety models, while at the same time acknowledging that we have to continue to make sure that we're not going to see exponential growth in armed law enforcement systems.
So what they ended up doing is, again, cutting almost 20% from the SPD budget, which we knew was going to happen. That's shifting the 911 operations away from SPD, parking enforcement. It's a lot of attrition. There was an effort, a long effort between Shama Sawant and Tammy Morales to take $9 million in recruitment dollars away from SPD. So that would have been kind of the equivalent of a hiring freeze, but that failed. And basically what happened is you had Lisa Herbold and Lorena Gonzalez, as you kind of heard right there, talking about, we realized later, after all of that, back at the beginning of summer, the community groups who are doing the research to try to re-envision whatever public safety is going to look like, they are in that research process. It's going to take at least a year to figure all of that out, and we don't have any other plans, so we cannot have a hiring freeze. We cannot not have the ability. Yeah. Especially with so many cops leaving. And during the meeting as well, they talked about they were expecting to see 89 officers leave the SPD this year. They're at 130, and I have my own sources who have it already higher than that, at more than a dozen just in the first couple of weeks of this month.
Wow. Why would they? So, but they did not do the hiring freeze, though.
No, they didn't do the hiring freeze.
So they can still recruit. And why would they want to stop recruitment? Because I thought that the police department was doing a great job, as Carmen Best was saying, of recruiting minorities and other people who are on board with the more enlightened approach to policing.
Well, and you heard Tammy Morales actually address that yesterday, too. She made clear, you know, she understands the discussion about diversity and all that's great. She said, just because you have a more diverse police force doesn't mean that they're not going to be racially biased, aggressive, and the problem that she sees them as. And there is not that unified, I don't think, belief as far as the need to recruit new diverse officers. They don't want to grow the department at all. They, in fact, want the department to go and go through the process that they have to, which is very involved, to do out of order layoffs. So when they do end up laying anybody off, it's not, they don't have to do the diverse, newer officers that they have. Yeah.
All right. Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. One of the interesting facts about the election was that, Donald Trump lost the popular vote and lost electoral college vote, but he came away with more votes than he did 4 years ago, and a surprising number of votes from people who can trace their heritage to Cuba and other places in Latin America. So I thought we'd call up Stephen Murphy, who's written a couple of books about Latin America, including his latest, Havana Odyssey, which is about the history of Cuba and the Castro regime. I wanted to ask you, because you still serve as a consultant on Latin America. Explain what it is, because I think it would surprise people, that makes Donald Trump so attractive to so many immigrants.
Well, I'm not sure that the Cuban Americans and Venezuelan Americans, particularly that voted for Trump in Florida, were really that attracted to Trump, but what they weren't attracted to was socialism. And the campaign in Florida and some of the other Hispanic communities focused a lot on Biden's and Kamala Harris's orientation towards socialism. And for people that have fled the Castro regime in Cuba or Maduro in Venezuela, socialism is not something that they cotton to.
Is this feeling something that's prevalent beyond the Miami area, or is that the focus of it?
I would say, Dave, that it's prevalent among those that have fled countries where the dictatorships were nominally socialist. And that includes certainly Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua. But more recently, it's included Mexico, because López Obrador, the current president of Mexico, whose security forces have been helped by the Cuban intelligence, is also going toward that direction and calling his movement a socialist movement. And that's turned off a lot of culturally conservative Mexican Americans as well.
Do you think the Democrats pay enough attention to that?
I'm not sure that all of them do. And it's something that they should certainly be aware of if the president-elect wants to appeal to all the people, because the Latino vote in this country, I think, is after the Caucasians, I think, is the second largest voting bloc. So I think if they were to ignore their concerns, they would do so at their electoral peril.
What is it about Kamala Harris that makes people think she would be a socialist in the vein of some of the leaders that you mentioned? Because it doesn't occur to me that either of them, certainly not Biden, that they're not going to nationalize industries, are they? They're not going to start arresting people for simply dissenting, are they?
No, I don't think that. But I think she seems to have... I'd have to look into her better into her voting record and her statements about Cuba. But any type of communication that kind of is opening to so-called socialist countries are they never forget that in these communities. So,
well, the idea, for example, of lifting the embargo against Cuba, is that basically off the table with this group of people?
Well, I don't think they would appreciate that unless there were some significant democratic reforms in Cuba. If there were actions by the current regime that would show that they're trying to become more diverse and less repressive.
And why does it remain so repressive? I mean, my experience in Cuba is the week we spent there, but the people were friendly. The country is beautiful. Why not open up a little bit so that you don't have... a system where everybody seems to be uniformly poor.
Let's put it like this. I mean, the Cubans that you met while you were there visiting and I met, yes, they're uniformly poor unless they are tied into the party or to the Raul Castro family or to any of the military generals that have special perks. Mm-hmm. The legacy of 60 plus years of kind of collective poverty, believe it or not, has kind of been ingrained in their mentality. And when I came to Cuba the second time, the taxi driver said, un momento, Señor Steve, we have to get some motor oil from my friend. I said, where's your friend get the motor oil? He said, well, he borrows it from the official pool and he owes me dollars and he pays in motor oil. And so that's how people get by. And for 60 years, people are used to that system.
But when it comes to preventing COVID, for example, as repressive and as poor as the country may be, they are running rings around us.
So first of all, I think they have more doctors per capita in Cuba than any other country in the world because they kind of mint doctors and they export them overseas. And so they have a significantly vast healthcare system, particularly in the large cities. But what they did when things really got bad at the end of March and April is they sent out these teams and they divided them up to make sure that everyone was masking up, was not going outside. And they had military support for enforcing kind of a total lockdown.
So to get back to the politics and what the lesson is for the Democrats here, it sounds like this idea that people from Latin American countries, that they're somehow going to be automatically Democrat, that's a fallacy. And that if the Democrats pursue this socialist idea too vigorously, they could find that portion of the electorate is going to vote against them.
Yes, I think they really should have a dialogue with members of the various Latin American communities to make sure they understand what's on their mind. And it's not just fighting the pandemic or having someone that's anti-immigration that will push them to vote. But, you know, they're also concerned about their livelihood. And a lot of the Latin Americans are small business people. So if you shut down totally the economy without an option for them to survive, they'll turn another way.
Stephen Murphy is a consultant on Latin America and also the author of Havana Odyssey. And Stephen, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Hasta luego.
He's an interesting man. And during the week or so that we spent in Cuba, we had discussions with the people that we met. And this is one of those tours where, of course, they choose the sites you visit. You're not allowed to just wander anywhere. But we brought up stuff like that. And their answer to the poverty part was, well, yes, we're poor, but we can send our kids to school and they'll come back alive. So that's the, you know, the image that they have of America. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.